Hello, everyone. Welcome to this first little podcast or whatever you want to call it these days. I'm joined today by Martin Jonasson, also known as Grapefruit. Hello, Martin.
Hello.
So some of you might know Martin from games like, he has made games like Hold Down, Rimmed Capsule, Twofold Ink, and most recently Subpar Pool. And Martin does the programming, design, and graphics for those games. And Martin is also in the indie game, like in the game dev community, maybe a bit famous for his Juice It or Lose It talk he did together with Petri Puro. So you might recognize him from that as well. And yeah, so we're gonna take some time here just to talk a bit about everything, you know, indie game dev related. It can be some programming, some design, some art stuff. So we'll see where it goes. Anyways, happy to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah,
it's always fun to talk shop.
Talk shop, yeah. So I was going to jump into something like an interesting question I actually got myself back when I released my game. And it was someone asked in a chat to me, how do you know that a game is actually done and ready for release? Say that you don't have a fixed release date. Yeah. How do you decide when it's done?
I think for me, I can usually tell when I'm getting tired of it. Because the way I tend to do projects, and I think projects in general, is like you have the fun bits and then you have the boring bits that you know you have to do, but it's very easy to do them. I can do them next week. And some of it is like you can't, like I can't do the final testing of the game until I know I'm not going to change. Like some things just have to be at the end. So I know that from the day I decide to, like, it's time to start finishing, it's going to take like 6 months or maybe a year to be done with it. But once I feel like, oh, this goddamn game, like I just want to get it out the door, it's time to start, like, okay, it's time to start leaving, sort of. And then I didn't, like, it's a tough call because it's never done, right?
Yeah.
There's always something more you can do. But for me, I feel like it's usually my own patience. That's the cutoff. Like, okay, I'm tired of this. I don't want to spend any more time making this better because it needs to go out the door. And I also feel like for every project I've made, the whole like launch thing is becoming bigger every time. Like there's more things to think of. With Subpar Pool, I did sim launch on iOS, Android, Steam, and Switch, which I've never done before, which was entirely doable. It's just like it takes a lot more planning and a lot more padding sort of at the end of the project. And it's challenging, especially with like Switch and console builds in general, because they have to be done like ideally 6 months before you launch them, because they got to go through certification and like you got to wait for the cert to be done to be allowed to do some things. And those things will take like another month. So you can't do the, oh, well, let's launch today, click the button thing that you can do on like Steam and even mobile kind of. So that makes it take a lot more planning and a lot more, it's a lot less sort of, I felt like launching today, so I did.
But I was also thinking from, you know, just that feeling of like, okay, the game is done. It's a strange, like, because, you know, you need to sort of choose the scope of the game somehow. And at some point you're like, okay, well, what will stay and what will go? And what do these things that I skip, are they important? Like choosing that kind of stuff, that's hard.
Yeah. And I think it's a weird thing being like a smaller, like a one person team or two person team, because it's very like, I'll get the idea, like, oh, I want to do such and such, like I want to add this feature, and I can't just add, well, I could just add that feature, and oftentimes I'll just do that, but like as I'm getting more experience, like I've done this a bunch of times, I realized that it's not just about the feature, it's also about like testing it, and maybe the worst bit of all, doing all the UI and like teaching it to the player. So it's not at all uncommon that I would just cut entire features because they're too complicated to explain to the player, or like I'll make them hidden features, like it exists but you need, like I won't explain it to you, you got to find it by yourself. Because explaining it, it's just not worth it. Like it's such a sensitive time bringing someone into your game and like messing it up by adding too much text or explanations or anything. Like the less stuff you have there, the better. And sometimes I'm okay with sacrificing like the long term, whatever,
yeah,
interestingness of the game on account of making the first 2 hours more hospitable.
Yeah, I had this exact experience with trying to, like, I was trying to make the tutorial for the game.
Yeah.
And what happened was it was hard to explain certain things because there was just one thing too many to explain at the beginning. And what I ended up doing was cutting one of the features and sort of merging them into another feature. And then suddenly the whole game just felt like, you know, the kind of like, oh, this is so nice now. Why didn't I do this earlier? Like I just deleted something from the game essentially.
Yeah. And feels then good too. Like I love that. Like less code, less bugs. Like it's that easy.
Yeah. I was thinking like, so your games, like you have two of your games, Hold Down and Two Folding. So Hold Down is this game where you bounce balls around and try to break blocks and dig deeper and stuff. And for those who haven't played it, that's my favorite Grapefruit game, by the way, Hold Down. I think it's super.
I think that's the agreed upon best one, not by me, but by like judging from sales and just like player numbers.
There's just something so nice and juicy about the game. But like games like Hold Down and Two Folding is this puzzle game where you sort of get bigger and bigger numbers by drag. Like how would you explain it?
Yeah, you've got like a grid of colored squares essentially, and you want to drag, like you can move the grid around. It's kind of like a match three, but it's different. So you want to drag between the colored squares and make one consecutive path through an entire area of color. Which is called a Hamiltonian path for all the is it, the graph is it, theory people.
Is it the path where it doubles, or is it the path that you have to visit all the points?
Hamiltonian
inside?
Path visits all the nodes, but it's not cyclic. Like it doesn't join up. It could, but it doesn't need to.
Oh yeah. So then I actually wonder, we can get back to this question I actually had. But so in Two Folding, so you there are like these fields of colors, and you must be able to make a continuous line between all the. We'll probably put some video on the screen of this. You need to be able to make a continuous line for all of them, and other, if you don't succeed, it kind of like just shakes a bit. When I was playing that, I was thinking like, oh, I wonder if he does like a cool mathematical way, or is it like brute force, like is checking the like going through each node and like checking is there any.
So it turns out like I was just messing with, I stumbled upon this mechanic sort of by accident, but it worked out really well. And in the beginning I was like, wow, this is cool. And you know this feeling when you have like, oh, this has to be a problem someone else has had before, like I bet this has a name. And I googled for it and I couldn't find it, so I started solving it, and then I found the name, and it's an Hamiltonian path. It's like a node theory or a graph theory thing, and it turns out it's an NP complete problem. Like there's no easy way to solve it. Like, you have to brute force it. So that's kind of what it's doing. But all I'm interested in is finding, like, once I, because there's a certain category of shape that's just not solvable. So like a T piece that has like three lone tiles, it's just not going to be solvable. So I know if there's more than two lone tiles, I can early out. So there's like a ton of ways I can like discard, like, I know this shape isn't solvable. But that was a fun programming thing, is to write that solver and figure out like, okay, how can I do this in the best way? And it caches everything it's seen before. So it's not like, usually the shapes are pretty small and pretty, like, the same ones will keep showing up. There's a worst case one where it's like the entire grid is one color except for one tile in the wrong spot, where it takes like, I don't know, 8 seconds because it has to try everything, because it could be solvable, but it's not. But that will, like, that never shows up in like normal play. I don't even think you could force it within the rules of the game. But that's like the worst one. That's the one I used for testing.
I was looking at it thinking like, some of these things might take a while, like take us some computation time to figure out.
Yeah, and some of them have multiple solutions. A lot of them have multiple solutions, but I don't care. Like, I will highlight it if it has one solution, then I'm done.
Yeah, so that, but that's actually what I wanted to go into. Like, so now we talk about Twofold Ink. I was wondering, like, how did the design of Twofold Ink start out? And I guess that's the answer, that you saw these kind of, you stumbled upon this problem.
I was playing a match three game for Twofold Ink. I was playing a match three game, and it was kind of like sloppy and weird in the matching. So I was like, I wanna try this, and I wanna see if I can make it like the way I wanted to make it. And like, there's a million match three games, so that didn't seem like fun. So it's like, what if you could drag like long shapes, and then I just what if'd myself into a whole game.
So I guess in that sense, it's like, you knew, you kind of, it like having an idea and, you know, starting out with something is like, this is weird period, I guess, like, oh, right now I'm just playing around, and then suddenly like, oh, maybe I can make this and ship it. And I guess, like, how do you have lots of those sort of periods where you're just trying something, or do you usually end up stumbling on something and playing with it for a while, and usually it works out and it's something you can ship? Or are there lots of discarded projects that are just like...
Yes. Lots and lots of projects that seem... Because it's like, I do this full time. So like, I have time to do this. And I just finished Summer Pool like last year. So I'm in that period right now where I'm trying to figure out what to do next. And it's terrifying to start like a multi-year project. So you just start a 1 week project, and then it gets 1 week longer, and then 1 week longer, and then 1 week longer. And then sometimes it just doesn't work out. Like, it will work great for some small prototype thing. Like, it's a great toy, but like figuring out like, okay, how can I make this work for not 10 minutes, but maybe 10 hours. And that's usually where it falls apart. Cause I can wrap my head around a small thing to be like, okay, I can sort of visualize how this is going to work for the small game and be like, okay, this is probably going to work. But for like the bigger, more overarching design of the thing, that's hard. I need to build that first to see if it works. I'm not that smart to be able to think about it. And in all honesty, I actually doubt that anyone is that smart that they can like figure it out beforehand and like write it down in a document and it'll work.
Yeah,
seems implausible to me, but there are many things I do not understand, so maybe.
Because you kind of see all the time, you know, I see on social media people posting like the first prototype of something, and everyone is like, oh, it looks super cool. You know, maybe it's like just a few rooms from a game with a single mechanic. And then, you know, many of these games are never shipped or finished. And sometimes people ask people like, oh, but what happened to this? And they're like, yeah, but it didn't work out. And I think all of them, maybe, well, many of them ended up in this situation where it's like, oh, it just, I didn't know how to make a whole game out of it.
Yeah, and I think that's a really common and dangerous trap, to be like something that works really great as a video on social media, where it's like, oh, wow, cool, 30 seconds of cool mechanic. Making that into, I don't know, 5-10 hours or even 2 hours of a game is not at all the same thing. Like, it's very different. Especially feels like this like cool puzzle 3D platformer, like there's a lot of that where you can like make a really cool trick and then it won't carry the entire game for multiple hours. You need 20 really cool tricks.
Yeah, and there are I guess there's many sort of things where you kind of start out with yourself with like, oh, this is like some neat stuff. And then you try to, and at the end, you know, you also have like, you know, it looks nice on a trailer, but the stuff sort of in between there can be like, oh, I'm just panicking, trying to add and remove stuff until something sort of, you know, until it works nicely and it's something that people really like to play with.
Yeah, and it's difficult to, because sometimes it takes a lot of time to make that and it doesn't work and you have to throw it away. I rarely feel bad about throwing stuff away because I'm mad at it.
Go away, you stupid game. Yeah,
like
game.
This stupid thing doesn't work. So like I feel good about, and like I still have it in version control.
Yeah.
So like it's not actually gone if I wanted it back, but like it's like, oh, the thing that doesn't work, I can just like turn it off and leave it over there in the corner and forget about it. Usually that feels good, I think. Yeah, because I don't know, video games, like they're so big. There's so many parts, even in like a small game, that the fewer you can get away with, the better it is. Almost always.
I guess there is some balance between, you know, the most, actually the most common problem with people not being able to ship a game is that they always start on a new game. Yeah. But then one also needs to have the opposite thing where you don't keep working on something that obviously doesn't work and ending up in that sweet spot. I think by then, you know, you've lost a lot of people. And I guess that's why so few games that get started actually ship.
Yeah, and it's like it's not just a question of being like knowing when to cut and when to not. It's also like economics. Like, can I afford to throw all this away and start over again? That's rarely true. Like, oh, I have like I've saved up some money. Like, I have a year to make my dream game.
Yeah,
I spent 8 months doing the wrong thing, and I need to start over. It's not fun. And I don't even know what to do in that situation. Like that's bad.
Yeah. I guess you have to, it's easy to get like tired of your game, I guess, and be like, I don't want to do this anymore. But then I guess try to push through that a bit. And even if you try to push through it and it still doesn't work, then you'll be like, oh, maybe I need to.
Yeah. And it's like, it's a thing that surprised me, because I did go to school for game design a long time ago. But even like that was long enough ago that like the whole indie scene wasn't really established. That sort of happened in parallel with me studying. So I never intended to be like a solo developer. And I never really considered how much of it is managing my own sort of mental state. Because if I'm having a shit day, the entire company is having a shit day and nothing's getting done.
Yeah.
And you can only force the entire company to do boring stuff for so long before they quit, even if it's me. Like, it doesn't matter. If I hate it, it's not like it's going to take a long time to get done and it might not get done at all. So figuring out a way to structure your work that you can actually do it, because it's a lot easier to do it if you don't hate it. And I think that's super individual. Like, I'm not going to even dare give any advice there, but like, it's something you have to think about. Like, you can only torture yourself for so long before you quit, even if it's yourself that's doing the torturing.
It's almost like, it's like small studio or solo development is almost like an exercise in sort of mental health.
Yeah.
Because if you have a big studio with lots of people, then you can kind of be more brute force, like, oh, we have to get it down, and then people are like, okay, and then, you know, somehow it all shakes into place. But when you're alone, everything stops if you stop, and if you do it for too long, like you say, there will be no game.
Yeah, and I think that's another thing of just having time that's super beneficial, to be like, you can allow yourself to have a shit day, or even a week, or sometimes a month. Like,
yeah,
you're not like, it's gonna go up and down. You're gonna have really great weeks and you're gonna have really bad weeks. Sometimes it's because the game's bad, sometimes it's because you is bad, you are bad. Sometimes it's something else entirely, like, oh, we live in Sweden, like, it's night 6 months a year. It's super hard to tell too, like, what is it? Like, I have a daughter, she's 9 years old. She woke up today and everyone's an absolute idiot. <I'm> like, have you considered that maybe you're in a bad mood? She had not considered that. In fact, everyone else was an idiot. But like, it's easy to laugh about when it's someone else, and even maybe when it's a kid. But like, it's a real thing. Sometimes it's you, sometimes it's everyone else. And yeah, you gotta figure out how to handle that stuff. On the other hand, there's a lot less meetings and like interpersonal stuff. So I maybe it all balances out in the end. I don't know.
Yeah. It's also kind of like, I worked at small studios with like 5 people. And even at that point we were like, oh, but it's okay. You know, this person is like, didn't sleep well today and is totally off. He's gonna just not work today. That's fine. While if you're like 20 people, then that starts becoming like, oh, why am I work? You know, people start to grumble, or at least the boss maybe starts to grumble. And then when you're alone, you can kind of like, I'm just gonna go into the forest and look for inspiration, as I call it.
Yeah, you don't have to explain it to anyone.
No, exactly. Like, only to yourself. Well, you don't have to explain it to yourself either.
Yeah,
you might try.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, people ask me, like, "Oh, how do you do about vacations and stuff like that when you're self-employed?" It's very easy. I just don't go like to the office or to work. Yeah, I just don't show up.
This area here, I leave.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't have to tell anyone in advance. I just don't go there.
Yeah. So I mentioned at the start this thing about juicy games. Like, you were in this talk some years ago with Petri Puro called Juice It or Lose It.
11 years ago.
11 years ago.
I think so.
Nice. When was that, when you were just starting out?
2012. No, it's 12 years ago. God damn.
Yeah. Time. Because when did you release your first big game, Rimmed Capsule, in
that was 2013, was that?
Yeah.
So that's the Use It Lose It talk is even before that.
This is your,
I think.
Yeah.
I gotta check.
I guess
important facts. 11 years ago, says YouTube.
Nice. So I guess I would say that many of your games sort of are adhere to this philosophy of that you need the juicy graphics where things are kind of, there's this, there's the things with you squish graphics, pitch sounds, shake the screen, deform the screen a bit when stuff happens, that yeah. to make the game just feel better for arbitrary reasons, I guess one could say. So in a game like Hold Down that we talked about before, where you kind of bounce balls around and there is constantly blocks being smashed and you get more and more balls and there's all this crazy stuff going on. I played this game and I thought that of all your games, I think Hold On is sort of almost like a showcase of the use it or lose it talk. Because it's sort of like, yeah. because I think, what's the game? I haven't watched Use It or Lose It in a long time. What's the game?
Is it like a breakout? It's like a breakout thing. Yeah.
And
so in a lot of ways, it's not that far away from Hold On.
Hmm.
The Use It or Lose It talk, like that, where that's obviously beyond anything reasonable. Just for effect.
I guess the Use It or Lose It talk kind of it when you're halfway through it, that's sort of when you should stop and then you go crazy to just yeah. as then it becomes more of a comedy thing, I guess, where you kind of everything just goes mad. But I think Hold On is sort of almost like a good showcase of this, how you can do it in a nice way. And I was wondering when I play it, like, when you have all these different effects where you pitch the sound and the squish graphics and shake stuff, do you have when you do the sort of programming of that, do you have I don't know what to say, like a juicy effect API or like some system that keeps track of all this? Or is it like ad hocly made and just ends up working everything in the end?
No, I think it's mostly just ad hoc because it's all like 1,000 different effects and they all are very specific for whatever they're doing. Hold Down is Unity. So it's a lot of just the Unity particle stuff. I have a thing. Hold Down has like a funny screen shake effect.
Where it sort of. It tilts the whole screen.
It's like the game is 2D, but it kind of has a little bit of depth. Like it's in planes and it doesn't move the camera sideways. It sort of tilts it like this. I've had people complain that they get actual motion sickness from
that. I thought it was super cool. That was like coolest screen shake effect ever.
Yeah. It's cool. I like it. But some people really don't like it. But you can turn it off. If you hate good things, you can turn it off. and for me, I really love doing the effects stuff. That's like the best part for me. So much so that I have like banned myself from even touching it for the first couple of months of a project. Like I'm not allowed to do effects because that's all I'll ever do if I just let myself go. And usually when I don't know what to do in a project, which tends to be a lot of the time, I'll just do some effects because it's a lot easier to do effects. Like you don't have to think about what's the overarching implications of this change? I'm going to blah, blah, blah. It's just like this corner of the game and the code and whatever, I'll do some cool things here. It'll take a day or two or three, and then it's done and it can stay here and it doesn't affect anything else. It's very nice to work on. It doesn't get the game more done necessarily, but it looks nice.
And I guess it's good to sort of also hold them off for a while so that you don't get too married to your features. Like if you need to cut something but it looks so nice. I put in all this juicy stuff and they're like,
And it really helps to sort of judge if the game is actually fun or if it just looks like it's fun. Like you'll give it to people and they're like, oh, wow, this is super cool. But it's really just like paint on a building that's falling down. It'll delay the inevitable reveal of this game is actually bad, but it looks like a good game.
Is it good to play test early without too much of that to see if the mechanics are fun? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I think so. But sometimes the whole thing is the juice. Like, that's the thing that makes it work.
Yeah.
There's this like age old thing of, I think it's like Doom 2 or whatever, where the playtesters were complaining that the double shotgun just wasn't good enough, like it wasn't doing enough damage. So they boosted the bass of the sound effect, and it was like, yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's good.
That was everyone's favorite weapon ever.
Yeah. And yeah, humans are pretty stupid, like game developers and non-game developers. Like it's easy to fool yourself and everyone else. So I prefer not to do the use too early, because it's like, it's almost a bit too powerful to mix in early in the project to be like,
It's actually quite funny, this thing with juice and stuff, because I talked to my girlfriend about it, and she just thought it was such a strange word. So I guess what if someone asks you what's your definition of juicing a video game? I guess they should go watch your talk, actually.
Yeah. We even have the definition in the talk, I think.
Ah,
let's see. Bring it up here, so I don't.
We'll link to it wherever we post this. But
a juicy game feels alive and responds to everything you do, with tons of cascading action and response for minimal user input.
Nice.
But I think it, like, the way, the ideal way to like, the best way to use it is for the, like, you put it where the player does something and you want to reward them for doing the thing. Not like in like any in-game currency terms or anything. It's just like, you did the thing. I noticed that you did the thing. Keep doing the thing. That's it, really. Like in the talk, we refer to, like, Emily Short has a thing. She's what you call it? Like, she writes like text games, narrative games. And even in that context where there aren't any graphics, it's just text, well, you can have the juice thing where, like, you try to do something and the game will be like, I see what you tried to do. Can't do it, but like, I have noticed you.
I guess it can sort of be used as like, when you have something in the game that's already important and you've tested it and, like, okay, this is a fun mechanic, I guess it almost becomes like a multiplier. Like, this, now this thing is even, like, if you just put it onto something arbitrary that's not that important, then it just becomes this, oh, this game looks nice, but, you know, it okay. But I think when it really kind of adds a lot is when this is the one of the most important things that happen in the game. And the player maybe already knows it, but now they really know, and it just feels good to do that. So it's like a multiplier of how nice it
is. Yeah, one of my favorite, like, using tricks is what I've named them sausages. Twofold uses them a lot. So when you score, there's like a little line that sort of goes whoop up to the score counter or whatever it changed, which looks cool. And it's super good to clarify, like, a thing happened here that affected the thing over here. So useful, really good. You can do it with particles too, like, just have them swoop up to the score counter or whatever. Very useful, very, it's good for everything.
That almost becomes like an implicit tutorial over time, because people, like, even if they haven't noticed that UI element where the score is, they will notice it, maybe not the first time, second, but maybe notice the third time when it happens or something. And I think it's a very interesting idea of just taking something from the sort of game world on the screen and moving it to the UI and doing that sort of like to make people notice, like, what's the connection between the game world and the UI, really.
And it doesn't even need to be the UI. It could be between things in the game. Like, you can do it anywhere. It's great. So useful. Everyone should do that.
So I downloaded two of your games on PC. I think it was Rimmed Capsule and Hold Down. And I noticed that they are tiny, like under 100 megabyte, which is in these days considered tiny. I know that, like, so one of your things is that you like making games that are like driven by simplicity, I guess, in some sense. But is the small size of the game here, is that part of your idea that you're trying to keep the size down, or is it simply a byproduct of it? Like, you, maybe you don't use so much textures or something because you want simple graphics.
A lot of it is that. I think Inum Capsule is the one texture, which, like, there's no point to having one texture. It just happened to be that way. Also, Inum Capsule is, like, more than 10 years old at this point. Or, yeah. Yeah. Back then, phone games, because it was like a mobile game at first. Like, ideally, you would keep it under like 25 megabytes.
Yeah.
It is bigger now because I changed, like, it's running on Unity now. So Unity is like, I don't know, 25, 30 megs. Just an empty Unity project will be that big. And then like 90 something percent of it is music and sound effects. Yeah. And then there's nothing else.
Yeah, that's I can just also say that we'll probably throw in a video of Rim Capsule, but I guess it's your first game. It's this kind of tower defense RTS with Tetris stuff.
Yeah, kind of hipster StarCraft, people who called it.
Hipster. Nice. And there's Monolith, so it feels very 2001 or something.
Yeah,
I like that. But what was I going to say here? That I don't remember what I was going to say.
That's fine. I can tell you that Twofold is probably even smaller because it doesn't have textures at all. Like, it's all vector graphics.
And the font is a TTF they just load in or something?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think, yeah, in the Unity, because I ported Rim Capsule and Twofold to use Unity, because they were getting really old in the tooth, and people do still buy them and play them some. So just to, like, stay up to date with the world, I moved them to Unity. So now it actually uses like a SDF font, I think. So it's no longer pure vector, but I think assigned distance field is fine by me.
Yeah, I think many people think about what's stored on disk, not what, like, even if you generate a bitmap font from a TTF,
yeah,
and you use that, then people will still be like, oh, but that, what's stored on disk is still just, you know, just no textures. But yeah, so
I guess, like, I care. You obviously care. Nobody else cares. Like, yeah. it's not important at all.
Yeah, but it's a few people who be like, oh, the game is under 100 megabytes. That's very cool. And it's true, like, the stuff you say about music, like, you can have the tiniest game ever, like, it can be under 2 megabytes, your game, and then suddenly it's like, you coded it in C and you made everything yourself, and you're like, it's so tiny, I'm just gonna add some music now. And unless you use like a tracker with like sample based tracker music, unless you do that, your game is gonna grow beyond 10 or 20 megabytes very quickly. Like, I don't know, it's like 5 megabytes per music track.
Yeah, and like there's like, as long as you're under, like, I don't know, 100, 200 megabytes, like, it doesn't matter. Like, the, I don't know, everything's so big now. My graphics drivers are like 800 megabytes. I don't know what they put in there.
It's probably 3 different versions of Electron or something for different Windows.
I don't know. And like phones, like everything has so much storage. Like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. But I think it's nice that people, like, some people still try sort of to keep things small. I mean, it's just a nice, it warms a few nerds' hearts. I guess that's nice.
With Rim Capsule had a funny thing too, because it, like, again, it's so old. You can only, back then at least, you could only play one, like, hardware decoded music track. Like, you could play an MP3 file.
Hmm.
And the hardware in the phone would take care of it. And like playing multiple tracks would like be work for the device. But I needed, because Rim Capsule has an ending, like an ending animation, and I needed to synchronize like the visuals with the audio, and it just wouldn't work with the compressed audio for some reason. So it's an for the longest time, it was an uncompressed WAV file, like a minute long. So the game was like 40 megabytes, and that WAV file was like 25.
Shipping solutions.
Yeah, it worked.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think at some point we made it mono, because like, I don't know, I feel bad about having this be stereo, because like that's half the size immediately. Yeah, now it's Unity. It's all compressed and good and probably about the same size, but it's a decade later. So
I guess that's an interesting thing then, because you used to, like, Rim Capsule, I think, maybe this is a twofold link as well, but I know Rim Capsule was made using Hacks, which is this multi-platform programming language. I think it's inspired by Flash.
It looks like very, very similar to ActionScript 3.
Because I guess you, do you come from like the, like, did you, your early games, were those like Flash games?
Yeah.
You have some kind of vector graphics feel to your games, and I guess, like you said, many of them use vector graphics.
I'm a Flash boy, born and raised. Before Adobe owned it, even.
OG Flash.
Yeah, such a cool piece of technology. Like, a lot of things you could do with that. When I studied at university many moons ago, like in 2006, I would do prototypes, like a prototype a week, and I would publish those, and I would get hundreds of thousands of people to play those shitty little games that I made and put up on websites, because you could do that. That wasn't like, oh, he's so popular, blah, blah, blah. You're just like, free games on the internet were that popular. Like, it was entirely doable to get that many plays. You'd never make any money from it. Actually, it would probably cost you money because of hosting and stuff. But even then, like, so long ago, before phones, before everything, like, web games were really a thing, and they were really popular. And people would just play any garbage.
Yeah, I kind of almost miss those Flash game websites, because I think it's also sort of like, maybe it's also because I was a kid or something, but you kind of go into it and it's like, oh, I'm just going to fun a fine game. And it is fun for 15 minutes, but that's fine. Now people are always like, you know, hunting, like, oh, does this worth my, I need 5 hours or something.
Yeah, but it's just kind of like the free-to-play thing is kind of back to that. Like, you have infinite choice. You don't even have to think about moving to the next game. Usually games will even have like ads for other games in them. Which is very similar to the Flash days. Like, if there's the slightest roadblocks, players would just move on. But like, back then there was a thing called Stumble Upon. Do you know this? Yeah. So like, it's a toolbar you put in your browser that just had a button for like next thing.
Give me things.
Yeah. It was like a social media thing. Like, you could submit stuff and like vote stuff up and vote stuff down. So like, there's just a button in your web browser that will take you to the next fun thing.
Who needs the algorithm social media feed when you have Stumble Upon?
No. I mean, arguably that's also an algorithm, but whatever.
I was asking about Hacks, because so you used Hacks for Rim Capsule, and I didn't know you had, is the version of Rim Capsule that's on Steam, is that ported from Hacks to Unity?
I don't know if I updated, because the Windows version, the old version, still works perfectly fine. So it's possible that I just left it. Mac version died in the 32-64-bit switch. So that one uses the new one. The mobile version uses the Unity one. But because it's Hacksy, and Hacks has this like cross-compiler thing, It will, like, the thing Haxi does, it will compile Haxi code directly to ActionScript 3 bytecode, which is not relevant anymore. But like, what would go in an SWF file? But it can also output other programming languages. Like, it will transpile the source code to another programming language. So porting to things is really easy because you don't have to interface with anything. I will just generate C# from the Primkapsel source code. And I will, like, that assumes like an ActionScript-like API. So I code the ActionScript-like API in C# in Unity as I would code anything. And I don't even have to do like externs or any of that crap. It's just like, it's C#. Like, it'll just find the things and it will work easily. There are some annoying bits, like Haxi doesn't have, it has null, like null is a big thing in Haxi. Like, everything can be null, like everything's an object. So some things don't exactly map one-to-one. The generated source code is a little bit annoying to read. There's a lot of parentheses and like belt and suspenders type things where it's like, it's just making extra double sure that it works the same way. But in general, it's really easy to port. It helps too that it's not using that much of the API. It's like playing sound effects and drawing things to the screen and nothing fancy. But I think I did the Rimkapsel and the twofold Unity ports in like a couple of months. Like, it didn't take long at all.
I guess that shows sort of some kind of, it's a nice showcase of when it's beneficial to have this sort of small API, like small API surface for whatever tool or thing you're using, because it makes it, I mean, this wouldn't have been possible, I guess. Maybe you would not have even tried if it was like hooking into every, I mean, maybe for example, porting a Unity game to some other engine, then it's like, okay, you know, if it's a full Unity game with all the poking everywhere in the engine, then you might be in trouble.
Yeah, and I feel like Flash and Unity, and I would assume every game engine that has like an editor, sort of encourages you to like go bleh, like spread things everywhere that don't have any real order to it, which is useful, but it also makes porting things really, really hard. I think especially with Unity, sometimes I miss the ability to be like, because if you're coding in like C or like any like custom game engine, you can always insert yourself anywhere in the like the call order of things. Like, oh shit, I need to read this config file before the game starts. You can just be like, stop everything, read the file, and then, okay, keep going. Yeah. In Unity, you can't really do that unless you thought of that before, because everything would just initialize however. But Unity has a lot of benefits as well. So like, it's a trade-off.
Yeah, is the reason you moved from Haxi to, now I pronounce it Hax. I never said the word. I think, is it supposed to be called Haxi?
I can't remember, but yeah, it doesn't.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I was like, Haxi. In Haxi, do you miss, like, I guess it was lots of technical reasons why you wanted to port them, to make sure that they ran on modern system stuff. You know, I mean, you mentioned the Mac stuff. Is there anything you miss from making, like, because now you've made games from scratch you've made games in Unity now. I guess your two latest games were made completely in Unity. Which is Holddown and Subpar Pool. Is there anything you miss from Haxi when working like that? Because I guess in Haxi you had sort of a more, there's less tools everywhere that you hook into, and more kind of just code, I guess.
Yeah, it's more code. You, like, it's, the whole stack is open source, so you can, like, if you need to change it, you can. The drawback is you will need to change it. back then, and I think even still, it's not, like, it's a hobbyist tool, which is fine. It's good. It's really good. But it's not made for like professional level production stuff, which means, and it's not like it's an open source thing. It doesn't get tested by anyone except for the people who are using it, and that's me. So like, oh, when Android or like Google Play is like, oh, we want to feature you, they have like a special list of like requirements that you need to fulfill, which is like a platform stuff, reasonable things like, oh, the back button on Android needs to work, like it needs to do the expected thing. And OpenFL just did not have it worked at some point in time and then just stopped working, and I had to like recompile the entire engine and all the dependency, like a multi-day trip into C++ land. And the engine is C++, Android is generally Java. You write the code in Haxi, so like you got at least three programming languages going on. And you can do it. It's just very, like, it's a lot of work. And the reason I switched to Unity late, I was a very late switcher, was that it's so much easier. Like, there's so many more people using Unity. It is realistic that I could open my office window and shout for help with Unity, and someone who could help me would hear me. Granted, I live in like a game dev city, but like it's that popular, like it's that common. And for OpenFL and with Haxi, if I needed a special library to do something like cloud saves on iOS, I'd have to write it myself or really try and find someone that I could pay that would write it for me. With Unity, like there's 1,000 ones already made. Half of them are free. Some of them are paid. Like there's so much to like. There's just a much more vibrant, living community. And it's C#. Like there's a bajillion libraries for C# that will do all the things you need, which is not the case for Haxi. Like there's a lot of them, but not that many. And also, like, I stepped off the Haxi train in, 2016?
Yeah.
Like, a long time ago. So I don't know what it's like today. I don't know that.
Yeah, if it's super nice now. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe soon we're all making Haxi games.
I do like the programming language. It's a cool programming language.
They've sort of replicated ActionScript, right? Like you said.
Yeah, that was the original like use case. They are called Motion Twin, I think. Who also are a game studio. Like fairly recently, they made what's it called? Motion Twin. I'm not googling this. Our games, Dead Cells.
Ah.
So the same people made Dead Cells, which I think is Haxi as well. It's not OpenFL, but it does use Haxi, the programming language.
Because I think the Dead Cells, I think the editor LDTK, that is like a grid-based level editor. Yeah. I think that's made by the Dead Cells devs. And unless I'm wrong, now I have to check this. Now we're just maybe. Yeah, it's a free open source editor that everyone likes. You know, it's sort of like the new generation's TileEd, if you remember TileEd, tile based editor, and now everyone loves LDTK.
They're also a cooperative, which is pretty unusual and cool.
Nice. So I guess can do one final thing here. I was just wondering about like your creating art. You do lots of vector-based art. I guess your latest game, Subpar Pool, which is a kind of combination of pool and golf, sort of.
Yeah.
I guess that one, when I play it, it has slightly more textures and stuff going on than your earlier games.
Because I didn't do the art for that one. I had an illustrator. Had an art director. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was art direction and stuff.
Yeah, I've been wanting to do more painterly stuff for a long time. And there are two challenges with that. One is like nice straight lines, easy to render, like from a technology standpoint. And I can do those. So to make this happen, I needed to figure out the tech to do like the squiggly lines on everything. Because like Sample Pool is actually 3D. The balls are like geometry, like 3D circles or spheres, I guess the term is.
I guess there's some shader on it to make it feel 2D-ish.
Yeah. And for the longest time, I was like, oh man, I can't do the squiggly outlines on the balls. And then I finally figured it out. So it's like a rim light shader. So it fades the ball out as the normal points away, like the exact same way you do rim lighting. But instead, I fade it to like a noise texture and I tone it down. So it wouldn't work for many other shapes, but it's perfect for the spheres, which was all I needed. And then everything else is like a whole mix of 1,000 different tricks to make it look like it was like drawn, which is hard. It's really hard. And it's really challenging to make it work in motion, because it's one thing to like a single frame that looks good, but like a scratchy like pencil drawing on a rough paper, it doesn't move. Like that's not...
Yeah.
Like there's no movement in that, and you don't want too much movement because it gets really, really noisy and weird, but you need some movement to sort of sell. Yeah, it's tricky, and I still haven't 100% figured it out. It turns out too that it's super dependent on like screen size and screen resolution and like display density essentially. So I got to like figure out like what kind of screen are you playing on and like scale the noise to match that. Kind of.
Is it because otherwise you almost get like a moire, like a super noisy, weird pattern and stuff?
Kind of, yeah. And like you want, like I essentially you want the noise size to be, because like if you draw something big, the noise stays the same size. Like if you draw a big circle or a small circle. But I also want it to be readable when it's small. So I got to make the noise like, it's tricky. And like it's got to work on, I don't know, like a living room, because it's on Switch. Like people could be playing it on their 65-inch TV, or they'll be playing it on their iPhone. And like a 65-inch TV in like landscape mode, or like their iPhone in portrait mode. There's a lot of different screen sizes. I feel like 2/3 of the Subpar Pool development time, which is me like resizing the window to be like, oh, does this work for every possible screen arrangement?
Doing something with more textures like that, was the old like your old methods for like getting juicy things into the game, was that, did that get a bit harder? Because I guess when you have everything in like vector shapes, it's easy to squish and go crazy. And
yeah,
when I think a bit more textures involved
for this one, there's a lot of like distance field stuff, which is good because it's more or less resolution independent. Like I can stretch and scale and flip and do things and it will still look good. Most of the illustrations are just flat. Like it's the wallpaper and it's like the cards. Those are like the most illustrative bits. And then the faces on all the balls and all of that. It's like, that's mostly procedural. Like it's based on what Sony drew. But like I re-implemented all of it as like more like tech art that I can do all the things with that I need, which is interesting too, because like it I'll see if I can find like a screenshot of how it looked before we did the first art pass, and it's a lot stiffer. It's like it's wearing a tie, and then that was a fun challenge. I want to do more of that. And it's also really nice to be, because I've always worked with a sound designer, Niklas, who's like my friend as well. We did Rymdkapsel together a long time ago, and it's so easy working with him because we think the same way. It's a really funny thing that happened, I think, with Hold Down. We were trying to make some little effect, I think, when you explode the planet at the end.
Yeah.
I would try to make the sound effects work, and usually like I'll go to his studio where he has like all the gear set up, And like I'll have prepared beforehand, like all the sounds we need to do, and like he starts doing them, and I'll just sit in the background drink coffee. Very nice way to work. we had this like sound effect for like the planet or the core like exploding, and it just didn't work right. It's like what the hell's wrong? And then I changed the color of the particle effects from like purple to white. And I'm like, yes, that's it. It was a white sound. It wasn't a purple sound.
So the sound didn't match the color of the thing,
which is just like that's stupid. And it was, but that was the correct solution for that particular issue, or if it not sounding right. And we have a good. Cooperation on that to be like, okay, what's the obvious solution to this problem? Okay, that's that. Let's not do that. Let's do the other one. And then sometimes we have to like come crawling back to the obvious one because that's the best one. But at least we'll try something stupid first.
I guess that's sort of interesting with, because I thought of that one because I've noticed that because I think all your four major games, Niklas has been doing the sound and music. And like that cooperation, like especially in sort of these, maybe in moments that require more programming, maybe sort of these moments where you pitch the sound a bit and you also want it to match very closely to the gameplay. Is it like, I guess there's this overlap between that you do some stuff like to the sound, but he take some feedback and I guess there's this overlap if you were
starting with Hold Down. We're using Fmod Studio, which is incredible, like such a, and for like indie scale projects, your budget's like under $500,000, which it probably is, it's free. Like you need to tell them that you're using it, but you don't have to pay anything. And the way it works is like I set up essentially an event in the code, which is like, oh, the thing happened. And that will match up with an event in Fmod Studio. It's like a separate piece of software. And I can send along parameters like, oh, the ball is moving. It's moving this fast. It's going this direction or whatever. Like it's this big, any parameter. And then it has like an editor inside of it that he can like set up like, oh, pitch it this way based upon the velocity or whatever. So usually he can set up whatever the hell he wants in the thing. It's a little bit scary because like he can do whatever he wants. Like he can add 1,000 filters and convolution reverb and all like expensive things. And it's all like sort of black box, but in mostly a good way, because like it just works and I haven't seen any real performance issues with it. But it's such a treat to be able to like, I can set everything up and just send it off to him and he can make something really cool with it. And sometimes he'll be like, oh, this is like, I need this value or whatever. Or I prepare a value for him and he's like, I don't need that. I can do it with the other thing.
And I guess it shows in because I felt like Hold Down had more, I don't know if it's due to like this cooperation using Fmod, but it felt like it had a bit more of like, there was more small things going on with audio in that one than when I thought a bit about your previous games. Do you think that's due to the giving the artist more, like the sound artist more control using Fmod?
And like the big thing, because like pitching stuff and like doing filters, like I could do that before, but the thing you can do in Fmod that's so much easier to be like you can group things into like a channel, be like, okay, this is the game effects, and then you can low pass all of those, or like you can send them to an echo, and you could do like big sort of, I mean, more mastering type things to the audio in the game, which I couldn't do before. Like, oh, you're about to die. Just low pass everything. Or Hold Down has the thing where like where the blocks fall, the music will slow down and the sound effects too. It's like, oh, that sounds really complicated, but I kind of want to try it. And I did it in like an hour, set it up to be like, it just worked.
And that's one of my favorite effects in that whole game. Like, when you figure out, oh yeah, it's due to the blocks that are falling, and then whenever you kind of almost anticipate that, and it feels good, like, oh no, yeah, I'm gonna get the nice slowdown sound and all that.
Yeah, and it actually sounds kind of bad because the music goes like out of tune a little bit when it slows down, but it's like, it's still good. It's still a good effect.
It's for a short period of time. It's fine.
Yeah. And it's like a funny consequence of that. Like the worm in the corner, he's dancing in time with the music. But when I slow it down, I sort of lose track of the BPM. Yeah. So there's a callback from Fmod every beat. So like he's like resyncing himself to be in time with the music all the time, which is like one of the major sources of crashes, because it's like calling into some C API or whatever. And if that goes wrong, it all explodes. Oh, wow. But I'm keeping it. It's worth it.
Yeah. All right. I think I've had a very nice little hour here. I guess you've just released your game last year in October or something, Subpar Pool. I guess people should go check that out. It's a nice game. Or check out your other games like Hold Down and Rim Capsule. And what's the last one?
Twofold
Inc. But yeah, anything you'd like to add or something that you...
No,
this is weird. It's an open question at the end. You'd like to say something.
I think in general, keep in mind that nobody knows what they're doing. my stumbling and bumbling along has somehow worked out. I don't know how that happened.
I think that's reassuring, actually, because people feel like everyone has it figured out, but actually no one has it really figured out. It just happened to figure itself out somehow.
Yeah, and sometimes people ask me like, oh, Martin, I wanna be an indie game developer. I want to get started. Like, how did you get started? Well, like, I made a successful game in 2013. That's like that's where you should start. That's the trajectory I'm on. That's the thing I can give you advice about.
It's not about being like early. You mean more like it's that you can't give advice because you did well in 2014, so you don't know what it's like starting out today.
No, exactly that. Like I have enough successful games sort of under my belt that I can email press and they will read the email, which is a huge like benefit. I don't know if that's going to last forever, but so far it's been... I can use it, but it's so different for anyone that's starting out now. I don't even dream to have any smart opinions about what to do or how to do it.
Yeah. Okay. But anyways, thank you a lot for joining. I will link to some of your games in the video or podcast or whatever you're listening, watching this on. So go try those out. And thanks for being here.
Hej då.
Hej då.